Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
People aspiring for a better life or feeling themselves blocked, feeling their social mobility blocked, have started to make very unwise political choices.
This program is made possible by the members and donors to the show. To support the work we do for as little as a dollar a month, or to sign up as a member and get commercial-free versions of every episode, plus members-only bonus content, find us on Patreon or visit the Contribute tab at bestoftheleft.com. Now, welcome to the award-winning Best of the Left podcast with clips today from This Is Hell, Ideas from the CBC, The Tom Hartman Program, PBS Frontline, and a TED Talk.
You write that there is much dispute about the causes of this global disorder. We are speaking with Pankaj Mishra. He is the author of the new book, Age of Anger, A History of the Present. You write there is much dispute about the causes of this global disorder. Many observers have characterized it as this backlash against an out-of-touch establishment, explaining Trump's victory, in the words of Thomas Piketty, as primarily due to the explosion in economic and geographic inequality in the United States. But you also quote Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman admitting on the night of Trump's victory that people like me, and probably like most readers of the New York Times, truly didn't understand the country we live in. You add, since the twin shocks of Brexit and the U.S. election, we have argued ineffectually about their causes while watching aghast as the new representatives of the downtrodden and the left behind, Trump and Nigel Farage, posing in a gold-plated lift, strut across a bewilderingly expanded theater of political absurdism. To you, what explains the ineffectual nature of the arguments over the causes of the U.S. election and Brexit? Isn't the cause neoliberalism, that at least here in the U.S., the Democratic Party's embrace of neoliberalism, essentially turning their backs on labor organizing and the working class? Isn't it that simple? And if it is that simple, why is it so hard for the left to realize that?
Well, I think, neoliberalism is a creed, as I was saying, that has been embraced by all kinds of people, including people who used to be on the left. And one of the essential principles of this particular way of thinking of human society or the good life is that human beings are primarily motivated by economic self-interest. So if you basically satisfy that particular self-interest, you have the makings, you have the ingredients for a relatively harmonious society. Now, this is really a big problem, because what you're essentially saying is that we, need better redistribution. We need the benefits of economic growth to be distributed much, much more fairly and evenly. But what it basically excludes, this particular economic perspective, is the actual experiences of human beings whose lives have been basically deeply, deeply disrupted by very opaque economic, political forces, people being laid off, jobs disappearing. And what you're basically offering to them is like, oh, we're just going to redistribute the economic benefits. This is simply not enough. I think you have to take into account, and trade unions, that you mentioned, labor organizations, they were simply not there to advance economic interests. They were also there to provide community, solidarity, identity to a whole lot of people who feel completely bereft without those. So this idea that we're all here in this planet, in this world, we are born to pursue our economic self-interest, really completely ignores all the other reasons for which we live, which make us happy, which make us sad. And, you know, what I'm trying to argue in the book is that we have catastrophically neglected all these other emotions that are also important. The search for dignity, the search for honor, the search for solidarity. When people lose their jobs, they not only lose a source of income, they lose their identity, they lose their face in the wider community. And these are devastating psychological shocks. And I just think the left has not really been cognizant of these problems. But as I also argue, we barely have a left. You know, this is a left that has no time for all the forms of solidarity. This is a left that is very much committed, has been committed to the neoliberal project with a bit of, you know, social welfareism on the side.
When it comes to this idea that we are homo economicus, that we are constantly working in our own best self-interest, do we need to completely rethink our world if we believe in that concept? Did we get some basic concept about our understanding of the world completely wrong? Is this the big truth that we truly believed in that in the end is false?
It is false. And look, this critique is nothing new. Let me be the first to admit it, that what I say in my book is nothing new. This critique of hyper-rationalism, this critique of conceiving of human beings as primarily economic, self-interested animals is almost as old as modernity itself, as the modern world itself. And it has been formulated, advanced by any number of thinkers, writers, philosophers, sociologists, historians over the last century and a half. You know, even someone like John Stuart Mill, who is often very wrongly seen as this sort of father of liberalism, he was very, very, very alert to just how this emphasis on calculating reason was a hugely destructive force, and how it basically alienated human beings. It became a huge source of oppression for human beings, and that was something to be resisted. So we've forgotten a lot of the most important lessons of our literature and philosophy over the last 200 years, and forgotten them, and sort of all plunged into this pursuit of wealth, of prosperity, of status, and that those are the pursuits, those are the fantasies that have been offered to us universally in the last three decades. And what you see now are people frustrated by their inability to realize those promises and lashing out often at people they hold responsible, whether rightly or not, for these failures. And, you know, one of their targets has been this technocratic liberal elite that has been essentially wending these fantasies around the world, and in which elites, they also include, often quite rightly, the media, the mainstream media.
You write, our current disregard of non-economic motivations is even more surprising when we learn that less than a century ago, the Enlightenment's narrow rational program for individual happiness had already become the butt of ridicule and contempt. As the Austrian modernist writer Robert Musil observed in 1922, indeed, the pioneering works of sociology and psychology, as well as modernist art and literature of the early 20th century, were defined in part by their insistence that there is more to human beings than rational egoism, competition and acquisition, more to society than a contract between logically calculating and autonomous individuals, and more to politics than impersonal technocrats devising hyper-rational schemes of progress with the help of polls, surveys, statistics, mathematical models, and technology. But why does that kind of unshackling us from the chains of quantification, why does that lead to a rise of the far right? Why doesn't standing up to this quantification of humanity lead to a rise of the left that has been critical of the market for all these years that the right seemingly has been supporting?
Well, the left has to reformulate its program. It has to emerge essentially from under this umbrella of a softer form of neoliberalism where it has been standing for so long. And basically, it has to stress these qualities that have been scandalously ignored all these decades, leaving human beings so vulnerable to demagogues. You know, what are demagogues offering them, after all? They're offering them security, they're offering them stability, they're offering them identity, they're offering them solidarity, they're offering them fraternity. These are traditionally left projects. The left has to understand that if it doesn't do the hard work, the right is always going to benefit, the far right in particular. And this is what we are seeing today, that the left simply failed to understand, whatever there is left of the left, it simply failed to understand that these imperatives, these ideas are important. And the far right has very successfully hijacked them. If you look at their agenda, if you look even look at Donald Trump's agenda, there's all kinds of progressivist ideas there. If you see Marine Le Pen's agenda, you know, she's the one who's offering the working classes a lot more than the traditional left in France has offered for decades now. So you see this extraordinary irony of the far right essentially appropriating all kinds of left notions today.
One last question for you, Pankaj. We have been speaking with award-winning writer Pankaj Mishra. He is the author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. His latest book prior to Age of Anger is 2013's From the Ruins of Empire, The Revolt Against the West and the Remaking of Asia. As we do with all of our guests, Pankaj, our final question is always the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience will hate your response. You quote the leader of the Liberal Party of Canada and leader of the official opposition from 2008 until 2011, Michael Ignatieff, writing, "Enlightenment, humanism, and rationalism can no longer adequately explain the world we're living in." A year ago, we spoke with Deirdre Reber, author of Coming to Our Senses, Affect, and An Order of Things for Global Culture, wherein Deirdre argues we have left an age of reason for an age of affect, an age of feeling. How effective is liberalism, is the idea that you should be able to offer a better case for your point of view and win your argument through logic and reason and debate? How effective is that kind of liberalism in an age when feeling trumps reason?
Well, I think liberalism will just have to work much, much harder than it has. It has depended too much on extremely vulgar and simple ideas about the human being as being motivated by economic self-interest. And I think it really now has to take into account a whole range of human experiences, a whole range of human aims and goals, if it has to remain, if it wishes to remain relevant, politically relevant in the years to come. It's because it systematically neglected these very important aspects of the human experience, is and basically blended into neoliberalism, which has been the dominant global ideology since the end of the Cold War. That's one reason why we are in this mess right now. So in order to get out of this mess, liberalism would have to reinvent itself, and it has done so in the past. Unfortunately, it has done so after a lot of catastrophes, such as the Second World War. And I just hope that we don't have to level large parts of the world into the ground before liberalism makes a comeback, that it would be able to learn from this eruption of the far right around the world and acknowledge that the far right emerges from the failures of liberalism, that liberalism is complicit in the emergence of the far right. I think it has to acknowledge that. Only then can it really begin to reform itself, reinvent itself.
And Pankaj, let me just stress to our listening audience that if you want to understand that the age that we are living in, if you want to understand what happened with Brexit, if you want to understand what happened with the election in November, you must read Age of Anger, A History of the Present. We've had a lot of people on the show who have been examining what was happening in the run-up to Trump's election as president. We've been talking to people since the election has happened, and we've talked about this age of fear. We've talked about this age of resentment. But this age of anger kind of brings it all together into one kind of unifying theory, and it really is fascinating. Go out and buy award-winning writer Pankaj Mishra's book, Age of Anger, A History of the Present. It really is a fascinating book.
It creeps all over you like a dull ache. Think of all the things your hands could make. It pulls you to the ground like soaking wet clothes. The change in your face when anger shows.
Integration in Germany. The integration of migrants is relatively successful in Germany. There was never before a time in German history when integration was as successful as it is today. Integration policy has clearly improved. The opportunities for minorities to participate in society are much better than even 20 or 50 years ago. Regardless of whether we focus on labor market, education system, living conditions, or the opportunities for political participation, all of that is better than 10, 20, or 30 years ago. But when you take a look at people's perceptions, when you examine the public discourse, you can see that the assessment and evaluation of people concerning integration processes is exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite, and this difference between measurable integration on the one side and the perceived integration on the other side seems to be crucial. If we want to understand the counter movements, we have to understand the perception of integration in general and the difference between measurable and perceived integration in particular. I will point out that difference in the following four areas. First, integration policy, then integration processes and their effects. Third, the relationship between integration and racism. And the last point, the perceived discrimination from the perspective of minorities. And in any case, I will talk about expectations we have and differences we make. So point one, integration policy. Of course, Germany made many mistakes in the past concerning integration. After World War II, labor was needed to build up the economy. Starting in the 1950s, labor migrants came from throughout the entire Mediterranean region, and these labor recruits were to be uneducated and have no ambitions because they were to focus solely on their given jobs. They were to work hard, but they were not supposed to stay permanently in Germany, and they were definitely not supposed to expect that they would really belong to German society one day. They were referred to as Gastarbeiter, guest workers. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know any culture in which people makes their guests work. And it's not common in Germany. Moreover, these guests in Germany were expected to do very hard manual labor. Very hard manual labor. So one could say they were not really full-fledged guests. They were only guests with regard to their not belonging. Well, the term Gastarbeiter itself makes clear how ill-defined integration policy was in that period, from the 1950s till the 1980s. There was no integration policy. And why should the integration of the Gastarbeiter be supported anyway? They were supposed to remain guests. That was the deal from both sides. But in reality, many stayed and are here to this day. And they received no language courses, no training, no further education. And for a long time, the children of these guest workers were placed in school classes separate from German children's classes for a long period. It was also very difficult to gain citizenship. It was nearly impossible. Everything which we currently refer to as integration policy did not exist. So that's why we started on a very low level. But no wonder we still have problems today. And in truth, most of these problems can be traced to the mistakes of the past, to the integration policy deficits of that time. Today, it is much better. For example, even refugees can expect language classes, labor market integration, an apartment, education, and training. Refugee children enter in regular classes, and the result is extraordinary. Today, an average adult Syrian refugee who came to Germany in 2015 already speaks better German than many guest workers who have lived in Germany for more than 50 years. In the 1960s and 1970s, I would have given German integration policy a score of 2 on a scale from 1 to 10. Today, I would give German integration policy a score of 7 out of 10. That is, of course, much better. But one thing we have to consider is, in the 1970s, integration policy was not seen as important. Integration was a foreign word, largely unknown in word and meaning. Today, integration policy is seen as the most important issue in domestic policy. And the expectations have risen considerably faster than the real improvements. And for an area of policy which has finally become the most important one, a score of 7 points out of 10 is apparently no longer enough. We are Germany. 7 points. That's not enough. The problem, though, is not the situation itself, but rather the discrepancy between expectations and reality. We are talking about a relationship. The expectations rise faster than the reality can deliver. And while real conditions improve, expectations are rising even more quickly, so nobody is really noticing the improvements. What exactly do we expect the result of successful integration to be?
Germany's approach to accommodating migrants has also had a worldwide impact. It's won admiration from champions of open societies and abhorrence from those who oppose them. But it's possible that violent disagreements about the whole migrant question stem from a very basic misapprehension.
I believe we completely have the wrong idea about what integration is supposed to lead to. There are constant disputes over the definition of integration. There are different concepts, different terms. So we don't only discuss integration, but also inclusion, diversity, participation, equal opportunities, and so on. These terms focus different phenomena and processes, but they all have one same effect. And we don't pay enough attention to this common effect. When integration or inclusion or equal opportunities are successfully implemented, they do not lead to a society which is more harmonious or free from conflict. On the contrary, the central effect of successful integration is actually a higher potential for conflicts.
It's at this point that Alaeddine sets into play the central metaphor of his talk, the dinner table. Imagine a dinner table where people from mainstream society have been seated for years. The door suddenly opens and newcomers join them. It's precisely this kind of scenario that much of the world is now confronting.
More people are sitting at the table and they all want a piece of the pie. More people are sitting at the table and want a piece of a pie. How is this supposed to lead to fewer conflicts? This idea is either naive and romantic, multicultural optimism, or it is hegemonic in the sense of expecting minorities to assimilate. Reality, however, looks different. I always describe the general integration process like this. The first generation migrants usually sit on the floor while the established citizens sit at the table. At this stage, the migrants are happy just to be there. They don't raise their voice, they're modest. But the second generation sits at the table and they want a piece of the pie. This is how successful integration leads to higher potential for conflict. The third generation, the grandchildren of the migrants, don't just want a piece of a pie. They want also to have a say in what is ordered, which pie is coming to the table next. And the potential for conflicts continues to grow in the third generation because the next step is to decide which recipe is used, the recipe of society. That is indeed what open societies promise, to have a say and to participate. And since a liberal and open immigration country has a new first generation every year, as well as a new second generation every year, as well as a new third generation every year, the situation continues to grow complexity. It will remain full of conflicts. At least the potential for conflicts increases. And that is new in all Western countries because openness and participation for all people and real integration for all people is new. It's relatively new. So what kind of conflicts am I talking about? First, conflicts of interest. Well-integrated people express their interests and needs actively and offensive. They organize themselves and work to realize their goals. Second, the resource conflicts. The competition increases in the jobs market, in the educational system, in the housing market, and so on. The third conflicts are conflicts in everyday life. The foreignness starts being seen as more problematic because we see the foreignness everywhere, in all sectors, in all positions, even in the media. If integration is successful, they are everywhere. One example which has been a focus of conflict in Germany as well as almost every other Western country is the headscarf, the Muslim headscarf. When I went to school in the 1980s and 1990s, I saw many headscarf-clad women entering and leaving my school every day. But nobody cared. Nobody cared about it. It was okay. But these women were badly integrated. They were not German citizens, spoke hardly any German. It was seen as okay, because these were just cleaning ladies. It wasn't okay anymore when the headscarf-clad women started becoming teachers, educating German children. These conditions made the headscarf into a problem. And I don't want to start a discussion right now about teachers with headscarves. What's relevant to me in this context is that this conflict arose only because the integration process and the participation had been successful. Integration leads to conflicts which didn't exist before and which would not exist at all if no integration had taken place. Integration changes a society. Unsuccessful integration, disintegration, leads to deviance, social problems, crime, of course. But successful integration leads to fundamental change and to conflicts.
Today's episode is sponsored by Bombas, the sock company that is on a mission to change the way you think about socks, or at least make you think about socks for the first time. Now, my personal relationship with socks could sort of be tracked like one of those Evolution of Man posters, but in reverse. As a child of the 80s, my first conscious sock choice was white, with neon stripes at the top, pulled up as far as I could get them. As my devolution played out, the socks got shorter and shorter, very, very slowly over time, starting above the calf, then below the calf, then above the ankle, and now I go with the under ankle style. And there's only one problem with the under ankle sock: sock slippage, wherein the back of the sock slips down into the shoe and it can cause blisters. Well, this is just one example of Bombas' attention to detail. They've created a sock slippage solution they call their blister tab, and now my socks stay exactly where they're supposed to. But that's just to get started. Every pair comes with built-in blister tab, innovative arch support, stay up technology, and a seamless toe. Plus, for every Bombas purchase you make, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need, because socks are the number one requested item at homeless shelters, but it's rare that anyone thinks to donate them. So to support their mission, buy one pair or four at bombas.com/left today and get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/left for 20% off. bombas.com/left.
Bannon is sometimes referred to as Svengali. Svengali was the bad guy in a 1898 novel, Trilby, by Georges de Maurier. And, you know, he hypnotized this young woman and took advantage of her for years and years. Wouldn't a better analogy be Rasputin? Who, you know,
I think it would be. Yeah. The Trump, Bannon is a guy whispering in Trump's ear. And I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, Bannon isn't a guy who suddenly came on the scene in August 2016 when he took over the campaign. He has known Trump and been whispering in his ear about politics since 2010, when they first met at Trump Tower, when Bannon was this conservative filmmaker, a Breitbart News guy. And I don't think that Bannon thought that Trump was going to run for president then, but Bannon, being slightly crazed and a fun-loving kind of guy, thought it was a lark to go up to Trump Tower and talk to Trump. But the two of them really connected. They have a lot of similarities. They both went to military schools. They were both business guys, deal makers. They both had a background in the entertainment industry. And they both had a lot of anger and a chip on their shoulder. And I think that kind of forged the connection and made Trump willing to listen and to embrace Bannon's hard right populist politics, especially the issue of immigration, which is what I think Bannon really brought to Trump.
Hmm. So and he brought immigration not in a what's best for the economy or what's best for the nation, but rather a, oh, my God, the brown people are coming away. Didn't
he brought a virulently anti-immigrant sentiment, both anti-undocumented immigrant and anti-legal immigrant. And I think Bannon, who'd produced a film in 2006 called Border Wars, where he was down on the U.S.-Mexico border. I think Bannon understood the visceral political power that the issue of illegal immigration has with a lot of conservatives, and I think he saw that that viewpoint wasn't really being represented in the mainstream Republican establishment, and he coached Trump to go right after, demonize, really, anybody with brown skin who was trying to get into the United States. And, of course, Trump, from the very get-go, when he came down the elevator in Trump Tower, what was the first thing he said in his rambling election speech? He called Mexicans rapists and drug dealers. That was pure, uncut Steve Bannon.
So what should we learn from this? I mean, to what extent has Trump completely absorbed this? And what does it mean for the future of our republic? What does it mean for the future of policy?
Well, I think for the future of policy under Trump, it's very disconcerting because, unlike a healthcare bill, Steve Bannon and Donald Trump can have, and already having, a profound effect on how our immigration laws are enforced. They can do that without having to pass legislation through Congress, as they do to unwind the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and they're doing this right across the regulatory board, by the way, from the Interior Department to FDA.
Exactly. I don't think it's happening anywhere with more force than it is on immigration, because Bannon told me during the transition, he said, "You watch, I'm going to employ the shock and awe strategy, and the very first thing we're going to do is go after immigration laws, immigration enforcement." He famously had the executive order banning immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations. It was held up by the courts, but caused these nationwide protests. Bannon told me that was intentional. I wanted people out there getting angry because I think that Americans really don't welcome immigrants, really don't want these people here. And if they see Donald Trump carrying out his promises to deport, to crack down, all these sorts of things, then they are going to understand that we in the Trump administration are carrying out our promises. And so these protests, far from being a bad thing, are really a good thing because people notice them and they see that Trump is doing what he says.
Protest against injustice. Say terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered. To some at our shows, shit right over wrong. Now it's time to hit the streets, back up those words you sung.
Because our voices alone this time will not get it done.
There's a brand new team in charge of the White House, a brand new staff to keep the wheels
turning. President Trump wakes up with a busy day ahead.
This is just the beginning of what is going to be a very busy day for Donald Trump.
Campaign advisor David Urban.
This president came to this town with a mindset after the election that he was going to shake things up. He was going to move at a much more rapid pace and shake the government up.
We're also expecting him to head to the Pentagon.
On his seventh day in office, President Donald Trump headed to the Pentagon. It was time for action. the White House and head to the
former Breitbart editor-at-large Ben Shapiro.
I do think that they wanted to have a flurry of activity at the beginning to demonstrate that, Trump is what he said he was. He's not going to wait. He's not going to take his time. He knows what to do, and he's going to fix everything. He's going to set the world right immediately.
Opportunity for him to meet with his Secretary of Defense, James Mattis.
It was the first time the new president had been to the Pentagon.
Not offering up details, but President Trump is expected to be...
The president is asking the military to use...
At Trump's side, his chief strategist, Stephen Bannon.
Washington Post reporter Robert Costa.
Trump has told me multiple times that he actually loves to fight. In Bannon, he saw someone who was just like him, someone who loved to fight.
Bannon had engineered a sweeping executive order aimed at fulfilling a campaign promise to restrict Muslims from entering the United States.
New York Times reporter Peter Baker.
That's Steve Bannon's idea, is to just throw everybody else off balance, knock them back before they have a chance to resist.
Until this moment, the order's details had been a well-kept secret in Washington, even among Trump's own team.
Business Week reporter Joshua Green.
They wanted to rush this thing through and get it out there and essentially take a shock and awe approach to changing immigration policy.
Defense Secretary Mattis, he knew very late in the process that this is what was going to be done during this visit.
Bannon didn't want other agencies to have a chance to see what was in this executive order and say, whoa, whoa, wait a minute, slow down. This might not be something we want to do.
John Kelly is the new Secretary of Homeland Security, a retired four-star general. He's on the phone being briefed on a helicopter while they're doing this announcement.
Protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. Big stuff.
Advisor David Urban.
The president's first and most important responsibility to the American people is to keep the homeland safe. And so I think that that's what the president was shooting for there, is to protect the homeland.
Bannon and the new president had sent a message. Change had come.
Robert Costa.
That was, in the eyes of Bannon, the way to rupture the establishment. They knew it was going to be disruptive. They wanted the disruption. Bannon sees disruption as power.
A scene of outrage at JFK Airport in New York.
Protests all across the country, the reaction from around the world after the president signed his executive order.
They knew that the protests would come. They knew the media would erupt. It's what they wanted.
Swift reaction from around the country.
Now protests, outrage, and backlash from presidents.
Joshua Green.
One senior Trump official said the fact that it came out on a Friday afternoon with no warning was no accident, because Bannon knew that people who were opposed to this policy would be enraged, and most of them would have Saturday and Sunday off from work, so they could get out there and they could protest and they could get angry. And TV cameras would come and film these protests. It would be all over the news.
Seattle police actually dispersed some crowds with pepper spray.
It would send the message to Trump's voters that Trump was keeping the promises that he made on the campaign trail.
Six more were arrested in Charlotte.
It had been a Steve Bannon production.
Former Breitbart spokesman Kurt Bardella.
Bannon thinks that this is great. We're killing it. We're winning. We're doing everything that we said we would. We are beating down the establishment and the liberals into submission. We are literally making America great again.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
A strategist, a revolutionary, a provocateur, Steve Bannon helped create a movement intent on transforming the country.
Thank you very much, Benjamin.
But Bannon himself rarely talks publicly about the worldview at the heart of his politics.
Speaking from Los Angeles today, right across the street from our headquarters in Los Angeles.
One exception, this video at a Vatican conference less than 3 years before he entered the White House.
Atlantic reporter Yuri Friedman.
He comes onto the screen. He's via Skype. It's a grainy video image. And he gives this speech where he talks about how Islam is a threat to Judeo-Christian civilization.
I believe the world, and particularly the Judeo-Christian West, is in a crisis.
Former Breitbart editor-at-large Ben Shapiro.
The threat that Bannon sees post-9/11 to the Judeo-Christian West is that radical Islamic theology is metastasizing into more mainstream Islamic communities.
We're at the very beginning stages of a very brutal and bloody conflict. We are in an outright war against jihadist Islamic fascism. And this war is I think, metastasizing almost far quicker than governments can handle it.
Bannon describes himself as a combatant in what he believes is an epic war.
Washington Post reporter Mark Fisher.
Steve Bannon sees America's dilemma at this stage in its history as really part of a civilizational battle between the forces of the West and faith and democracy versus that of Islam and terrorism. And he has kind of reduced all of the conflicts of modern society to that essential face-off between the terrorists and the Americans.
Here's some big news. The always opinionated advice columnist Dan Savage of Savage Love and Savage Love Cast has a new podcast called Hot Mic, available everywhere starting August 8th. The series from Audible features a curated selection of the very best live stories about sex and relationships from storytelling shows across the country. Plus, you'll also hear from comedians, singers, and porn stars who share their stories, songs, and thoughts on relationships and the art of revealing your sex life on stage. Some of the featured guests include Rachel Bloom, Jen Kirkman, Jesse Klein, Michael Yeo, Greg Barrett, Kevin Allison, Guy Branum, and many more. And of course, you can expect Dan Savage to share some hilarious commentary, opinions, pieces of advice, and stories of his own. So you're not going to want to miss it. Check out the new episodes, two available already, of Hot Mic with Dan Savage every Tuesday starting August 8th. Available on Audible, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I started my conversation with Pankaj Mishra by asking him when he first began noticing what he calls the global civil war. It's something you noticed first in 2014, and I want to know what exactly sparked your interest in that war.
Well, I think, you know, the eruption of animosities, political animosities, not only between parties, mainstream political parties, but within families, for instance, in India, and we saw this again when Trump was elected. Any number of people I met in the United States last couple of weeks who confessed to having fought running battles with family members who voted for Trump, and this was likewise a situation for many, many people in India who were flabbergasted by the spectacle of people in their own families voting for a man who they thought, quite rightly, ought to be serving a long prison sentence. And here he was being elected the Prime Minister of India by, you know, a large margin. So I think the triumph of a demagogue in this instance, and, you know, he had a long political record, which was pretty disgraceful. And, you know, he had been written off many times. And here he was making this big comeback, causing deep divisions in Indian society at large with his rhetoric. And then, of course, we've seen in the last 3 years, those divisions deepen. So that was my first experience, at least the first very intimate experience of this, what I call a global civil war, where people aspiring for a better life or feeling themselves blocked, feeling their social mobility blocked, have started to make very unwise political choices and therefore alienating a lot of people around them. And also, in a way, condemning their societies, the societies in which they live, to a kind of low-intensity conflict, which may last for several years. You know, of course, we know that the global civil war manifests itself in extremely violent forms, too, in many countries around the world. But what we have seen in many democracies today is the eruption, the emergence of strong polarities and divisions.
A lot has happened since that 2014 election in India. I mean, since then, we've had the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom. We've had Donald Trump, and we continually read reports about what's going on in the Middle East with ISIS. People around the world, and politicians are among those people sometimes, see the terrorist threat right now, this sort of radical Islamist threat, as the West's biggest issue, the biggest problem we're facing. But you reject that. Why?
Well, I think, you know, we are now finding out with the eruption of far-right fanaticism in the very heart of the modern West that fundamentalism, extremism, political fanaticism of this kind is simply not unique to Muslim societies or countries in Asia and Africa. And this is, you know, partly what my book also illuminates, that these movements of violence fueled by militant disaffection have erupted over and over again in Europe. In fact, that is where we first witnessed terrorism. And they have, you know, continually emerged as a result of various economic crises, as a consequence of certain factors. When they come together, you will have a small minority of people resorting to violence. And it has happened, you know, as recently as the 1970s and 1980s in Western Europe. So terrorism, or using terrorism as a tactic, it's certainly not unique to Muslim societies. We have also seen it in India. We've seen it in Thailand. I've just returned from Burma, where Buddhist monks have resorted to ethnic cleansing and to the kind of violence that, you know, is certainly not sanctioned in any Buddhist texts that I at least know of. So I think we made a catastrophic mistake after 9/11 when we located the source of militant violence in Islam and tried to identify a particular community that was breeding this poison of terrorism. We just completely ignored this very long history in which people of all religious, racial, ethnic, national backgrounds had resorted to terrorism. So I think, you know, in many ways, we are living with the consequences today of that mistake we made soon after 9/11 in that, you know, bigotry of the kind that was unleashed back then is now being institutionalized in government policy by all kinds of far-right demagogues who seized upon this issue and turned the Muslim community in Europe and America as basically a scapegoat. The same fate that many Jews suffered in the late 19th century during a time of economic crisis, when they were singled out as the source of suffering for, you know, all the masses who were being victimized by these global flows of labor and capital back then.
It seems to be an issue or a problem that is much more widespread than people are willing to think, if not almost a universal problem.
It really is. I mean, I think, you know, scapegoating is an ancient practice, and it seems like no matter how secular or rational or modern we might think ourselves to be, certain human traits or certain pathologies of human societies are never very far behind us, and scapegoating is clearly one of them.
Can you help us see the connection then between the kind of people you're talking about, the cultural nationalism that was part of Italian fascism 100 years ago, and the kind of chauvinism we're now seeing in Donald Trump's America, or beyond that, in Islamist or Buddhist or Hindu nationalists anywhere in the globe?
So, you know, I think the connection between them is not that they're all alike, which will be a very silly and shallow thing to say, but that one kind of disaffection in a particular context leads to anarchist violence, it leads to terrorism, it leads to young people embracing essentially extreme violence as a way of being in the world. The other kind of disaffection makes people identify scapegoats, various imaginary culprits for their suffering. It makes them join cultist organizations, extreme, of a kind of extremist persuasion. What is important is to keep and focus the particular political conditions, the economic crisis from which these pathologies emerge.
These are the times, said Thomas Paine, that try men's souls. And they're trying ours now. This is a fateful moment in the history of the West. We've seen divisive elections and divided societies. We've seen a growth of extremism in politics and religion, all of it fueled by anxiety, uncertainty, and fear of a world that's changing almost faster than we can bear, and the sure knowledge that it's going to change faster still. I have a friend in Washington. I asked him, what was it like being in America during the recent presidential election? He said to me, well, it was like the man sitting on the deck of the Titanic with a glass of whiskey in his hand, and he's saying, I know I asked for ice. But this is ridiculous. So, is there something we can do, each of us, to be able to face the future without fear? I think there is. And one way into it is to see that perhaps the most simple way into a culture and into an age is to ask, what do people worship? People have worshipped so many different things, the sun, the stars, the storm. Some people worship many gods, some one, some none. In the 19th and 20th centuries, people worshipped the nation, the Aryan race, the communist state. What do we worship? I think future anthropologists will take a look at the books we read on self-help, self-realization, self-esteem. They look at the way we talk about morality as being true to oneself, the way we talk about politics as a matter of individual rights, and they'll look at this wonderful new religious ritual we have created. You know the one? Called the selfie. And I think they'll conclude that what we worship in our time is the self, the me, the I. And this is great. It's liberating, it's empowering, it's wonderful. But don't forget that biologically we're social animals. We spent most of our evolutionary history in small groups. We need those face-to-face interactions where we learn the choreography of altruism, and where we create those spiritual goods like friendship and trust and loyalty and love that redeem our solitude. When we have too much of the I and too little of the we can find ourselves vulnerable, fearful, and alone. It was no accident that Sherry Turkle of MIT called the book she wrote on the impact of social media alone together. So I think the simplest way of safeguarding the future you is to strengthen the future us in three dimensions: the us of relationship, the us of identity, and the us of responsibility. So let me first take the us of relationship, and here, forgive me if I get personal. Once upon a time, a very long time ago, I was a 20-year-old undergraduate studying philosophy. I was into Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Sartre and Camus. I was full of ontological uncertainty and existential angst. It was terrific. I was self-obsessed and thoroughly unpleasant to know, until one day I saw across the courtyard a girl who was everything that I wasn't. She radiated sunshine. She emanated joy. I found out her name was Elaine. We met, we talked, we married, and 47 years, 3 children and 8 grandchildren later, I can safely say, was the best decision I ever took in my life, because it's the people not like us that make us grow. And that is why I think we have to do just that. The trouble with Google filters, Facebook friends, and reading the news by narrowcasting rather than broadcasting means that we're surrounded almost entirely by people like us, whose views, whose opinions, whose prejudices even are just like ours. And Cass Sunstein of Harvard has shown that if we surround ourselves with people with the same views as us, we get more extreme. I think we need to renew those face-to-face encounters with the people not like us. I think we need to do that in order to realize that we can disagree strongly and yet still stay friends. It's in those face-to-face encounters that we discover that the people not like us are just people like us. And actually, every time we hold out the hand of friendship to what somebody not like us, whose class or creed or color are different from ours, we heal one of the fractures of our wounded world. That is the us of relationship. Second is the us of identity. Let me give you a thought experiment. Have you been to Washington? Have you seen the memorials? Absolutely fascinating. There's the Lincoln Memorial. Gettysburg Address on one side, second inaugural on the other. You go to the Jefferson Memorial, screeds of text. Martin Luther King Memorial, more than 12 quotes from his speeches. I didn't realize in America you read memorials. Now go to the equivalent in London in Parliament Square, and you will see that the monument to David Lloyd George contains 3 words. David Lloyd George. Nelson Mandela gets 2. Churchill gets just 1. Churchill. Why the difference? I'll tell you why the difference. Because America was from the outset a nation of wave after wave of immigrants. So it had to create an identity, which it did by telling a story which you learned at school, you read on memorials, and you heard repeated in presidential inaugural addresses. Britain, until recently, wasn't a nation of immigrants, so it could take identity for granted. The trouble is now, the 2 things have happened, which shouldn't have happened together. The first thing is, in the West, we've stopped telling the story of who we are and why, even in America. And at the same time, immigration is higher than it's ever been before. So when you tell the story and your identity is strong, you can welcome the stranger. But when you stop telling the story, your identity gets weak and you feel threatened by the stranger. And that's bad. I tell you, Jews have been scattered and dispersed and exiled for 2,000 years. We never lost our identity. Why? Because at least once a year on the festival of Passover, we told our story and we taught it to our children and we ate the unleavened bread of affliction and tasted the bitter herbs of slavery. So we never lost our identity. I think collectively we've got to get back to telling our story, who we are, where we came from, what ideals by which we live. And if that happens, we'll become strong enough to welcome the stranger and say, come and share our lives, share our stories, share our aspirations and dreams. That is the us of identity. And finally, the us of responsibility. Do you know something? My favorite phrase in all of politics, very American phrase, is we the people. Why we the people? Because it says that we all share collective responsibility for our collective future. And that's how things really are and should be. Have you noticed how magical thinking has taken over our politics? So we say, all you've got to do is elect this strong leader and he or she will solve all our problems for us. Believe me, that is magical thinking. And then we get the extremes, the far right, the far left, the extreme religious and the extreme anti-religious, the far right dreaming of a golden age that never was, the far left dreaming of a utopia that never will be, and the religious and anti-religious equally convinced that all it takes is God or the absence of God to save us from ourselves. That too is magical thinking, because the only people who will save us from ourselves is we, the people, all of us together. And when we do that, and when we move from the politics of me to the politics of all of us together, we rediscover those beautiful counterintuitive truths that a nation is strong when it cares for the weak, that it becomes rich when it cares for the poor, it becomes invulnerable when it cares about the vulnerable. That is what makes great nations. So here is my simple suggestion. It might just change your life, and it might just help to begin to change the world. Do a search and replace operation on the text of your mind. And wherever you encounter the word self, substitute the word other. So instead of self-help, other help. Instead of self-esteem, other esteem. And if you do that, you will begin to feel the power of what for me is one of the most moving sentences in all of religious literature. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. We can face any future without fear, so long as we know we will not face it alone. So for the sake of the future you, together, let us strengthen the future us.
We've just heard clips today, starting with This Is Hell, speaking with Pankaj Mishra about his book, Age of Anger. Ideas from the CBC looked at a new way of seeing conflict as an inherent part of successfully integrating societies rather than something to be feared and avoided at all costs. Tom Hartman spoke with Joshua Green about the strategic harnessing of anger by Bannon and Trump, as best demonstrated by the Muslim ban. PBS Frontline gave us a documentary insight into the Muslim ban as well as Bannon's underlying philosophy. Next, there was another segment from CBC's Ideas, also speaking with Pankaj Mishra about globalized anger and the scapegoats we use to misplace that anger. And finally, we just heard a TED Talk by Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks about how to face the future Without Fear, together. You can find links to each of these segments in the show notes for easy reference and sharing. And although I do have a voicemail to play for you today, I'm going to do that in a few minutes and tell you a story first. This is the story that came to my mind today while putting this episode together. Now, for longtime listeners, you may recall that before this podcast inexplicably became my job, the work I was doing way back in the day was work at a climate change nonprofit organization. And all at the beginning of my time there, way back in 2007, I was approached by the executive director, and he's like, "Hey, listen, you produce these podcasts, right? So obviously you can edit audio. Do you think you could do that, but with video?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." And he said, "Okay, well, try anyway. We want to buy you a camera and, you know, computer and the software you need, and we want to start producing videos based on our activism that we do, and we want to put them on YouTube and start getting the message out about all the great work we're doing in a, you know, nicely produced, packaged sort of way using video." And I thought, well, shit, I guess I don't know how to do that, but I'll learn. And the very first event that I filmed and the first video that I put together, we were protesting the Bush administration at the State Department. Remember, this is 2007, and he had put together, after, you know, years of basically denying the existence of climate change, he was putting together this sort of fake international meeting to discuss climate change and totally not do anything about it. And so a bunch of organizations came together, and we were all protesting at the State Department at once. And I was filming and produce this video. It was a two-day action. First, there was civil disobedience the first day. A bunch of people were arrested. And then the second day, there was just a sort of normal rally with marching and speeches and cheering and all of that sort of thing. And as we were preparing for the speeches, someone said that the plan was, you know, one of the speakers, sort of the keynote speaker on that second day, was going to be Van Jones. And I had never heard of this person before. He went on to become the Obama administration green job czar and has been involved in lots of different organizations. He's on CNN. He's a commentator. He does all kinds of things. He's just sort of a progressive Renaissance man. And over the years, I've had plenty of problems with things he's said. He's a quirky, strange, complicated dude. So he says lots of great things, and then every once in a while, a kind of sort of thing. But this very first time I met him, he was introduced to me before the event, before I met him. He was introduced to me because he was described as the keynote speaker, and the plan was to bring on Van Jones, and he's going to just knock the ball out of the park, home run speech like he always does, because that is what he's known for. He is excellent at giving speeches, and he said something incredibly powerful during this speech, and I put it in the video. I'm going to play it for you in a second, and this phrase has been sticking in my head for a full decade, and it came very much to mind today, because what today's episode is all about is this globalized, borderless anger, frustration with the status quo. And what almost no one is talking about is that all of this is being exacerbated by climate change. Every frustration about neoliberal politics or globalization or refugees or immigrants or any of these things that people find themselves being frustrated about, what is not being talked about is the part that climate change plays in making all of these situations worse, making everyone's anger more heightened. And it will only continue to do this as sea levels rise and more people are displaced and there are more famines and more floods and people have to move to survive more and more and more. Heat waves and droughts and all of these things will cause wars and conflict as they have already begun to do. So, as I say, Van Jones was one speaker of many at this particular event.
No, George Bush, you don't get a cookie for acknowledging a problem that the whole world now acknowledges.
And keep in mind, this is less than 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, a very intersectional economic, climate, human, racist disaster. And Van Jones begins using this metaphor.
If somebody is struggling, let them sink or swim. Let them sink or swim. And you cut on TV 2 years ago, and you saw people sinking.
And when he brings this metaphor to its conclusion, he says the words that have been ringing in my head for the last 10 years. And these words are my response to all of the elements displayed in today's episode. It's my response to the problems we have with immigration and refugees. It's my response to every issue that we need to deal with in the face of climate change.
We're living in a post-Katrina age. You and I and this whole movement have to say with one voice, we reject any philosophy, any economic policy, any political worldview that says, let people sink or swim in an age of floods. We reject it. We reject it. We reject it.
Like I said, the dude knows how to give a speech. And in case you were interested in checking out my very first attempt at filming and editing a short video, it was received pretty well, I think. I will leave that link in the show notes. It's only 5 minutes long, so if you want to check it out, it won't take up too much of your time. And now, as promised, a voicemail.
Hi, Jay. This is Laura from Alameda, California. Recently, on one of the voicemails, the person suggested going down to one episode per week as a solution to your increased workload. And I just wanted to say that I really, 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 really hope that is not what happens. Best of Left is such a fantastic podcast, and you do such a great job of finding all of these great clips from the left. And I think part of the reason why your workload has gotten so huge lately is because there's just this huge amount of content from the left that there's just more and more of it. And I think it really kind of got kicked off with Bernie Sanders running and awakening a lot of progressives up. And now, of course, we're under the Trump administration, so it's all about the resistance. So you're having to go through more and more content because the left is producing so much great content. And now more than ever, we need to amplify that. And that's obviously the mission of Best of the Left. So I hope that we can find a way to keep Best of the Left 2 episodes a week, because I think that's a great amount of content. And I think there's just more and more stuff to be going through to find that best content. And I think it is important, though, that we find a way to make it so that you have a manageable workload. And so I think retreating a little bit right now for you to figure out kind of this new reality that we're living in and how best to go forward under your wonderful leadership should hopefully get us into a good position for the future. And so I think it's important that, you know, if you're scaling back, it's hopefully just a temporary thing. I don't think we can afford to scale back. I think we need to be scaling up and building our teams stronger and stronger. And hopefully we can find ways to leverage volunteers to make it so that your workload is decreased and becomes manageable, but also so that there's more people who are invested into Best of the Left, both as contributors financially and in terms of time and talent. So I just wanted to say, I really hope that the way forward is to continue with 2 episodes per week. Thank you for all you do. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much to Laura for her kind and thoughtful comments. I just wanted to play that as prelude to some good, if possibly slightly mysterious, news I have for you. And as Laura was referencing, I have already scaled back the show. You may already be aware. I used to do 8 episodes new each month for the most part. And I've scaled that back to 6. So 2 episodes a month are scheduled as reruns. But that doesn't mean I've actually been working less. It means I've been working less on production of the show, but I've been working more on other stuff. And what I've been working on is trying to figure out how to work differently, how to work smarter. And again, as Laura guessed, a lot of that work has been focused on figuring out how to integrate volunteers into the production of the show. Now, the first bit of good news is that this isn't the first time I've done this. So I kind of know what I'm doing, and I kind of know what works and doesn't work, and I think I can make it work. And the other piece of good news is I've actually already launched a thing. I have done a very, very soft, like feather pillow soft launch of this new program that I have been working on, and a self-selected group of members who heard me talking about this on the Members Only show, for members only, as you might guess, signed up and have been sort of checking it out and helping me build it and giving feedback and all those sorts of great things that super, super early adopters do. And now what I want to do is just the next level up of opening it up. So I'm telling everyone that this thing exists, but it doesn't quite fully exist in earnest. It's not absolutely ready for prime time, but if you want to find out what's going on, if you want to find out how to volunteer, if you're super excited to figure out how to be part of this, simply send me an email and I will respond and give you access. So here is basically what I'm looking for. I'm looking for volunteers of two stripes, listeners and editors. It's pretty simple. It's almost self-explanatory. As you might imagine, the production of this show requires a whole lot of listening, and you, as podcast and news junkies, are perfectly suited to help with that. If you know how to listen to a podcast, which I know you do, if you know how to read a calendar and a digital clock, as I suspect you probably do, then you are qualified to help gather clips for the show. You listen to the things you like, you note in what episodes you hear something good, you note the times within which that good thing was said, and then you submit it to us. On the flip side of that is that we need editors to help edit out and do the actual electronic splicing and splitting process of cutting up clips and sending them to me. And of course, one person could do both of those jobs. I certainly have been. So if you are interested in volunteering in either or both of those capacities, you are the prime suspect that I am looking for. And as I said, you can just get in touch with me, jay@bestoftheleft.com. Say, hey, what's up with this volunteer thing? I want in on that. And I will give you early access. Not to worry for the rest of you. If you want to wait, you're like, I don't know. I don't need to be an early adopter, but I'll see what happens when it is actually fully ready. And then Jay will tell us all about it. And then maybe I'll sign up. That's fine too. So there you go. That is some good news already in the bag, with the promise of more good news coming along the way. And I'm pretty excited about what I'm working on. I think you guys are going to like it. And if you want early access, just send me an email and I'll get you all set up. As always, keep the comments coming in. The number again, 202-999-3991. And before I go, a quick reminder that Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. And for every pair of socks you buy, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. To get yourself a pair or more, visit bombas.com/left right now, and you'll get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/left. And also remember that the always opinionated Dan Savage of Savage Love and Savage Lovecast has a new podcast coming out today, Hot Mic. It's available everywhere. This series from Audible features a curated selection of live stories about sex and relationships, as well as interviews with guests like Rachel Bloom, Jen Kirkman, Kevin Allison, and Guy Branum. And of course, expect to hear a few stories from Dan himself. So check out new episodes of Hot Mic with Dan Savage every Tuesday, available right now, available on Audible, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Now, thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to all those who support the show by becoming a member or making donations of any size on patreon.com, as that is absolutely how the program survives. Of course, everyone can support the show just by telling everyone you know about it and leaving us glowing reviews on iTunes and Facebook to help others find the show. You can also help us in our mission to aggregate and amplify the best progressive media by joining up with us on Facebook and Twitter and sharing all of the great content we're putting out there. And for details on the show itself, including links to all of the sources and music used in this and every episode, all that information can always be found in the show notes on the blog. So coming to you from inside the Beltway, yet outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you every Tuesday and Friday, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestoftheleft.com. And it's a crying shame how we get so trained. See you.